Okay, welcome back. I think this is lecture 10. So we were just starting off on the slide set on MPLS, and let's get going. So we were seeing how IP was being mapped to ATM, and we were just reviewing the philosophy of IP and ATM. So in contrast to IP's philosophy, ATM could be thought of as the perfectionist dream. Okay. Now, in fact, ATM had set itself a 10-year timeline to reach this perfection. Okay, one of these, the idea of perfection was that you anticipate everything in the future and factor them in. Okay, in particular, all forms of quality of service that you might ever want, and build the most complex, or I mean, most sophisticated routing protocol, most sophisticated type sets of services, and best congestion control protocol, best of everything. Okay, so, indeed it did, and in fact, if you look at some of the routing protocols and some of the congestion control mechanisms and so on, right, and in terms of high-speed switching, there were several components of ATM where, in fact, it delivered what it wanted to do, okay, but just the fact that you are putting all of them, you are force-fitting all of them together, and you are not allowing a network to be built without them, right, was a big deal. So it was sort of a philosophical mismatch, and therefore, we saw this detailed story in the last class about why the overlay model for IP over ATM internet working ran into problems, especially when you want to try to map large IP networks. I mean, take a large network and then map IP on top of that. Okay, so the LAN part became easy. I mean, it was solved, but then the cost of the IP over the lane solution was still larger than Ethernet. Therefore, it was not a commercial success. But then they had much more serious problems trying to map IP over ATM, because now they not only had the problem of address resolution, but they also had a problem of routing. Okay, that's what you're going to take a look at right now. So remember that what we mean by an overlay network in practice is the following. Okay, I want to have a bunch of these X's, which are essentially ATM switches, and then I have a physical view of running A, B, C, or a protocol here called an IP protocol on top of this. So I'm overlaying these IP nodes on top of a network which is just doing ATM. And at the logical level, A seems to communicate with C, C seems to communicate with B, and A seems to communicate with B. Okay, I have this full connectivity. Okay, but then this is actually realized over ATM virtual circuits which you need to set up. Okay, that is one way of looking at the overlay problem. Okay, as we saw in the data plane, one problem was easily solved. The packet format mapping was easily solved. But then the address resolution was not so easily solved. Okay, in particular, you needed to have a whole set of servers, okay, and then you had to sort of either synchronize them, you need to maintain virtual circuits with the servers, and then have fault tolerance backup capabilities. Okay, so and then multicast became an even bigger problem, but I mean, that was a moot point, because multicast itself didn't succeed in IP very much. And then cut-through forwarding across logical IP subnets became a big problem just from an ATM ARP point of view. But the very reason why you put a boundary between these subnets was because of a routing question, which I shall survey right now. Okay, the second issue, which is probably the biggest problem, was when you map one protocol on top of the other, you just don't just map the data plane, you also map the control plane. Okay, and this particular piece is not very well discussed in textbooks as well. Even if you take a good MPLS textbook, this issue is not very well discussed. Okay, so suppose I want to take a protocol like OSPF or BGP. Okay, these are the canonical and big IP protocols which we want to map onto ATM. Okay, now what are the fundamental problems? Okay, now you have to see what do these protocols expect of lower levels. If you take an OSPF, right, and it's a link state protocol, it collects information about its neighboring links, and then it floods it. Okay, so it needs some kind of a flooding mechanism. Okay, so you need the IP to ATM mapping to provide some flooding capability. That's number one. Okay, so how do I flood? Okay, and do I consider an ATM virtual circuit as a single link, or the entire ATM network as though it's a fully connected network? Do I consider it as though it's the same as a broadcast network like an Ethernet network? How does the OSPF routing view the network for the purposes of Dijkstra's path computation? Okay, so that is one of the problems in OSPF. The other sort of problem in OSPF is that I need to have nodes which are routers, which are called routers, and these routers are assumed to be directly connected to each other. In other words, they need to maintain adjacency, or they need to send hellos to each other. I'll send a hello and you reply. Okay, if I don't receive in hello replies from you, I know you're dead. So that's how I know whether a link is up or down. Okay, these are fundamental sort of ideas in any link state protocol. Okay, now we want to map these fundamental ideas at the network level, I mean, or the IP level, to the ATM level. Okay, now how do I realize that? It turns out that this is a fairly non-trivial problem, as we shall see very quickly. Okay, now not I'm only going to take the case of OSPF. Okay, now BGP is even bigger nightmare. Okay, so now if you study BGP in the Internet Protocols class, again there are lectures online. If you forgot what I'm talking about. BGP is broken up into two parts. One is called exterior BGP, that is, I take one autonomous system and then have BGP which communicates with outside the autonomous system, but within the autonomous system, all BGP routers need to talk to each other. In other words, they need to synchronize the information. Okay, and that operation is known as an IBGP problem, or internal BGP problem, and that is not really a routing protocol, it's just a synchronization method for talking with each other, making sure all of us are talking about the same thing. Okay, all of us are synchronized and we are not having routing loops. Okay, so that part is IBGP, but then IBGP is like an adjacency that must be established between every pair of BGP routers. So it's like a full mesh. Okay, now as you know, full meshes don't scale, and then there are some solutions in the BGP space for simple IP networks. But then mapping a full mesh at the adjacency level or the BGP peer level to an ATM virtual circuit will inherit some of the same problems as we shall study in OSPF. So essentially, what will happen is that you will soon run into a flood of virtual circuits you need to set up to support IP routing protocols, just for supporting basic operations of IP routing protocols, and the whole thing doesn't scale. So why it doesn't scale? If you have to set up lots of virtual circuits just spuriously to transfer IP control messages, and if you are actually getting a virtual circuit on a lease, that is, you don't own the network, but you're actually getting a virtual circuit, you have to pay for every circuit. Okay, and I mean, paying for every circuit means that each of these circuits become a cost for you. So if I have n square virtual circuits that need to be established, okay, and you're going to have a huge amount of cost. So these were all practical considerations in terms of mapping routing protocols. Okay, so let's study one case, in particular OSPF, carefully. Okay, now as I said, OSPF, normally basic OSPF, when you study it, it sounds all very fairly straightforward. I want to collect the map of the network, and I'm assuming each of the links of the network are point-to-point links, right? All this is okay for basic OSPF, but now once you start even trying mapping OSPF to Ethernet or an extended LAN made out of Ethernets, all these assumptions don't hold. Okay, the Ethernet is not a point-to-point network. It has a bus, right? The bus is good for broadcast and sending ARP and doing all those things, but it's horrible for maintaining OSPF adjacencies, because now in a bus, if there are many routers, do I regard the bus as though it's one link, or do I regard the bus as though it's a link between every pair of routers? If it is every pair of routers, then I have to maintain adjacencies between every pair of routers, even though there's only one physical link, which I need to send around these spurious adjacencies. So OSPF is complicated. In fact, RIP RFC is so thin, like just a few pages and 25 lines of code, whereas OSPF is like a 150-page document, which, and much more larger in terms of code base. Okay, and one of the reasons it's so complex is because of different ways it provides to map the basic OSPF ideas to various sorts of subnets. Okay, one subnet is known as a broadcast subnet. Now, when you try to map OSPF to a non-broadcast subnet like ATM, you come into another set of, you open up another can of worms. Okay, and it works like this. Okay, ATM is non-broadcast access medium. You cannot throw a packet and expect it to go everywhere. Okay. And as I said, every virtual circuit, if you're leasing it or you're basically renting it, is costly. So setting up full mesh of virtual circuits gets costly. Okay. So even if you just want to maintain adjacencies, I cannot send hellos unless I have a virtual circuit. Now you start seeing the problem with virtual circuits, right? I want to do something fairly trivial, send one packet around, but I need a virtual circuit, and I have to pay up the big bucks for that, right? So now you see why the circuit-oriented model starts becoming not so attractive, right? So, and then not only do you need to maintain these neighbor relationships, that is, whenever I say hello messages, it means that I know that you are next to me and I know we have a link, but I need to monitor the link all the time. That's why I send hello messages, to maintain this neighbor relationship, or called an adjacency. There is also another type of adjacency called a flooding adjacency. Okay, what this means is that suppose one OSPF router gets an LSA or what is known as a link state advertisement, whom should I send this link state advertisement to next? Okay, in other words, I'm supposed to flood this LSA to others. Okay, on a bus, what you would like to do is just drop the LSA on the bus, and all routers can pick it up, as though it's a multicast flood. Okay, whereas in ATM, I will also have to set up floods to every other router. Okay, you can optimize this using the usual technique. Instead of flooding it to everybody else, you can form one super ATM router, and you send all the floods to this ATM router like the server. And then this server establishes a multicast ATM connection to all other ATM routers, and then it relays this flood messages. Okay, so these are known as flooding adjacencies. So the mapping of IP OSPF to ATM becomes complex because you need to manage these hello adjacencies, you need to manage these flooding adjacencies, and each of this has a different degree of complexity and amount of traffic. Okay, and it turns out that the flooding adjacencies, there are two ways to do it, and both of them are not very satisfactory. Okay, so the one way to do it is follows. Okay, suppose we have so many routers and then there's this ATM cloud. What you do is you break up this ATM cloud into fully connected segments. Okay, fully connected means if you look at this triangle, right? Triangle means everybody can talk to each other. Okay, in other words, they have a VC to each other, and then make this a subnet. Okay, remember why we need this. The reason we need it is in the IP subnet model, there's a very simple but subtle assumption that in a subnet, any node can reach any other node. Okay, in other words, you don't need, it's a directly connected network. That's what a subnet model implicitly assumes. So that model can only be supported in a virtual circuit based network if I have virtual circuits or a fully connected mesh of virtual circuits. Obviously, it is unlikely to find a large network where you have virtual circuits to everybody else, otherwise you'll have n square virtual circuits. But what you can do is you can sort of break it up into cliques or smaller graphs, and you make each of these a separate subnet. So now you see why the LIS divisions had to be made in the RFC 1577. In the 1577 RFC, we saw these boundaries, right? And I said, okay, one part of this is one subnet, another part is another subnet, right? The reason is that for mapping the IP subnet model to ATM, you had to have a full connectivity in terms of virtual circuits. So the only way you could do it without running into an explosion of virtual circuits is to break it up into fully connected cliques, okay? And these, you would have LIS boundaries at these points. Okay, so this is one model, which confusingly enough is called NBMA model. Okay, NBMA also stands for an attribute of the network that it doesn't support non-broadcast. But NBMA model in the context of OSPF also refers to a specific mapping of the OSPF routing protocol to ATM or into other frame relay type protocols. So the way you run this the details are that neighbor discovery, you don't actually send hellos. Okay, once you set up a virtual circuit, you assume it's reliable, you just manually configure it. You don't actually send hellos, no more hellos. Okay, and as far as the Dijkstra algorithm, it views this entire network, okay, as a full mesh. Okay, so that is one of the reasons. So I have a fully connected network here, and I have routers here. So this whole thing I view as though it is there are links everywhere. Okay, so what one of the sort of side effects of this is that the Dijkstra complexity or the computation complexity of Dijkstra increases with the number of links. So if I'm going to view this as a full mesh, the computation complexity of Dijkstra at the OSPF level is going to increase. Okay, remember the Dijkstra, when I say Dijkstra, it's the algorithm for computing the shortest path. Okay, once I have the map, once I have all the link states, once I have the link state database. Okay, so an alternate model was proposed. What essentially, it has again another funny name. Okay, it's called the point to multipoint model. Okay, now I don't know why they came up with this name. Okay, it doesn't make any sense. Okay, so essentially, what the only thing which really they made a change was, instead of breaking this whole thing into smaller cliques, okay, I wanted to have one large IP, one large subnet, right? Remember, I did not want to break this ATM network into these LIS boundaries. I wanted to have fewer LISs, or I wanted to have one large network. So, but they made one critical design decision here. In IP, right, you assume that the subnet is fully connected, or in the subnet, anybody can reach anybody else directly. For example, if you take this network, right, these dotted lines are the only virtual circuits which are available. Okay, what that also means is, suppose I take this 10.6.6.1, router A, it does not have a direct virtual circuit to 10.6.6.4 or router D, but you assign it artificially the same subnet number. Okay, this whole thing is called subnet 10.6.6.0. Okay, now remember what this means. It means that there are two routers which now lie on the same subnet, but they cannot communicate directly because I don't have a virtual circuit between them. Okay, this is an artificial constraint imposed by ATM. Because I just cannot have a full mesh of virtual circuits, I have to break the IP subnet model. Okay, now what this point to multipoint mapping model essentially says is that that cost is worth taking. I'd rather break the IP subnet model for the purposes of mapping IP to OSPF to ATM rather than deal with the complexities of the NBMA model, which lead to all kinds of things. I mean, it leads to much smaller subnets, it leads to these LIS boundaries and suboptimal routing across ATM clouds. Okay, that cut through capability was not available. Okay, but unfortunately, this point to multipoint model showed up only very late in the game. Okay, it was a reasonable solution to the IP over ATM mapping problem, especially at least for OSPF. It didn't solve BGP's problem. BGP had even bigger problems. BGP said that if I want to have router A and router D, both of them need to send IBGP information to each other. There's no way you can get rid of that. Okay, so you have to send IBGP synchronization messages, okay, which forced you to have a virtual circuit, even though you solved the OSPF problem through the subverting model, right? The point to multipoint model. Okay. Anyway, so the quick comparison between the two ways of mapping OSPF routing protocol to ATM is an NBMA method where I assume a full mesh of PVCs or full mesh of virtual circuits, but I'm forced to have smaller logical IP subnets or smaller LISs from the perspective of the RFC 1577. But in reality, most organizations cannot afford to have this. They typically have a hub and spoke type architecture where you have, like Walmart will have at its IT distribution center, it will have its main switch, and all these Walmart stores will have one connection or one frame relay connection to that particular node. Okay, so I can't afford to have one frame relay connection or one ATM connection from every Walmart store to every other Walmart store in the country, right? So that will be immediately expensive, especially because Walmart is going to pay to whichever service provider is providing it. So these kinds of things said that, okay, let me go and build, use the point to multipoint subnet model at the price of breaking the IP, original IP assumptions. That is, two routers, the same network should be able to talk to each other. Okay, so you sort of quietly ignore that assumption. Okay, anyways, so in the NBMA case, to just give you a sense of other complexities which arise, not only do you have to maintain these flooding, these hello adjacencies, when I get an LSA, I need to flood to other LSAs. I need to send this to everybody else. So if I don't have a direct connection to everybody else, I need to have a super router or super ATM switch to which I maintain connections to. And then this also has a multicast outgoing virtual circuit which connects back to everybody else. So it essentially relays. Okay, if you notice this and this, right, it sounds very familiar. Okay, if you remember when we talked about topology, right, in the original class on networking concepts, we said that whenever I have a full mesh, I can convert it into a hubbed architecture, right, or a star topology. This is a star topology, right? So this is instead of having a full mesh topology at the routing adjacency level, I am replacing that with a star topology. Instead of having a full mesh, I am replacing it with a star. But this is essentially the same idea. So that this topology is logical, as is this. Okay, and what essentially the function of this super box in this case is that it will originate an LSA for this entire network. Instead of sending, each of these nodes will not generate its own LSA or link state advertisement. It will generate its own, it will generate a standard LSA for this entire network and announce it to other networks. That's number one. And the other thing is it will relay advertisements which it receives from anybody else. So if this router R4 receives an LSA, it will send it to R1.5 and then this will be relayed again. And this is also used to maintain hello messages exactly. So this particular super router is called a designated router, okay, in this model. It's called a DR. Okay, and just like anything which is a star topology, like we saw in server based model, right, the server can fail, right? So what if the DR fails? So there is a backup DR. Okay, so just like you had a DR, you had to have a backup DR, and all of these fellows need to maintain a connection or a virtual circuit with both the DR and backup DR. Okay, and not only is that, these two things there, and what if the backup DR also fails, right? So they have some kind of a complex leader election protocol, and a new DR shows up, and you have to form virtual circuits with that and so on. So you can see this whole thing becomes very complicated very fast. Okay, so I'm going to skip this. Okay, anyway, the summary of this is that if I want to take IP as is, or the IP protocol stack as is and ATM protocol stack as is, and just form this glue is not as easy as one might think. This glue is very trivial if you just want to map the packet formats. Okay, but it becomes much more complex when you want to do address resolution, and even more complex when you want to do mapping of the routing protocol or the control plane side of things, right? That's the basic idea. And what happened in practice is that competition emerged in all these directions. Okay, as far as the data plane, even though you say that you can do the RFC 1483 fairly easily, there emerged a new class of routers known as packet over SONET routers. What it said is that take an IP packet, send it to PPP, and then directly map it to SONET. Why do I need this ATM in between? Right. So essentially, you disintermediate ATM and directly transmit over SONET. Okay. You sort of critically examine what I need from ATM, and say I don't need this anymore. Okay. So if I'm willing to build a very straightforward network where I don't need complex quality of service, or I just want to patch together a quick service provider network, I don't need all this ATM business. Okay, I can. So this allowed the emergence of a large number of small ISPs. Okay, if you see in the world, if you count the total number of carriers who implement telephone services, there are very few. But if you compare them to the world of ISPs, there are thousands of ISPs. Over 7,000 ISPs exist. So the reason why they emerged is because for building their core networks, they could just patch together a packet over SONET based router with standard OSPF and BGP. Okay, without worrying about any IP to ATM mapping. Okay, and in terms of the overhead, if I take AL5 and the basic ATM packet header overhead and other types of overhead, it can be as much as 20%. It can be anywhere from 15-20%. It was deemed to be too excessive, and especially because I'm paying money for each of the circuits. Okay, so these were the major problems. So people went back to the drawing board. Okay, so they really wanted to build large networks, and this was a big crisis in mid 90s. Okay, so I remember going through all these standard bodies at this time. So there was a new back to the basics approach. So let's look at what is the fundamental of routing. What does routing really do, and what does switching really do? Switching was thought of as this phenomenon that came from the telephone networks, and routing was thought of as this data networking phenomenon. People went back to the philosophical groups and asked, What is it really? Okay, so then they came along this company which took the concept of switching and then took it to the LAN, right? I said this company was called Kalpana. It was bought later by Cisco, and then Cisco became a major player in the LAN switching market. So they said, okay, what is the switching? Suddenly this is appearing in the LAN market. Why can't I take the concept of switching, and instead of doing at layer 2, okay, which is what LAN switching is about, why don't I do switching at layer 3? Okay, what is fundamentally different from taking a router and putting a switch fabric in it, okay, and an ATM, okay? So why can't I do whatever I want? Okay, so another thing which an emergence of high speed routers. We shall look at that later next class. But then another thing which was considered is, now the overlay model does not work because it's very hard to map the IP control plane to the ATM control plane, right? So what they said is, why don't we try a hybrid? Okay, let me take an ATM switch. What's great about it? Its forwarding plane is great. Okay, and people actually hated some of these ATM signaling protocols, even the PNNI was thought to be too complex by some. Okay, so they said, let me throw out ATM's control plane. Okay, take ATM's data plane, which has high speed forwarding, which I really want, and takes IP's control plane, and then mix them together and form a network. Okay, and a company which pioneered this was called Ypsilon, and it gave the name called IP switching. Okay, what it said was, instead of trying to do an overlay model of taking unchanged protocols and forming a glue, let me actually create a hybrid, which means I'm violating the overlay principle. I'm actually taking one piece of one and another piece of another and creating a new box and create this box. Okay, so this was called an IP switching box. Okay, and so you can differentiate between IP routing versus IP switching. So IP routing would use slow IP routers at that time, and the alternate was to go over ATM, but I need to do IP over ATM, which is not working very well. So then what I do is I take IP routing protocols which are working okay and take ATM switching hardware which was working really fast, and then do a map, develop a new box which does both of that. Okay, so that's the idea. So you want to do high speed switching, you want to leverage the high speed switching capability of ATM, and then you want to just use IP routing on it and forget about all these mapping protocol problems. See, if you take ATM switching capability, right, the mapping from IP packets to ATM switches was fairly straightforward. I just break it up into cells, right? It's the same as 1483. Okay, that was known to be done. Okay, now the other two big problems, the address resolution problem and the control plane mapping problem, both of them went away. The reason is that they developed a very simple signaling protocol and for this whole setup called IP switching, as well as they just co-opted the IP control plane. Since there was no ATM control plane to be dealt with, there's nothing to map to. So just take the IP protocol as is. So you just bypass an entire set of problems. Okay, and that is the solution which is called IP switching, which is today comes under the name of multi-protocol label switching. Okay, so MPL is basically, you can think of it as somewhere in the middle. Okay, now time division multiplexing and ATM lie on the right side of the scale between circuit switching and packet switching, and when both of them came together, they sort of co-opted some of the best ideas of both worlds, and you form this thing called MPLS. Okay, now you should never fall into this trap of saying when I take best of both worlds, it's something that's desirable. Okay, so nobody cares about combining best of both worlds unless you really need the properties of both. Okay, and this so MPLS doesn't make sense in a LAN or a local area network. It only makes sense in a large ISP network where you'd like to provide all these complex services, you'd like to manage traffic and reduce the costs, etc. Okay, so this MPLS and IP today is being deployed in fairly large networks, but at the same time the competitor to that, which is standard OSPF and point-to-point links and packet over SONET, is also continuing to exist. So there are considerable deployments of MPLS right now over the last few years. There are still lots of deployments of OSPF over packet over SONET, and there are considerable deployments of ATM and IP over ATM. So that's the real world today. Okay, so the history comes from a very simple principle. Instead of trying to do overlay, try to do hybrid. That is, take the control plane of IP, take the data plane of ATM, put them together. Okay, and the fascinating thing which the Ypsilon guy said was that you can do this by just taking existing ATM switches, which was even more incredible. What that means is take an off-the-shelf ATM switch, okay, which Ypsilon could build, or it could buy from some other company like Four, which was building ATM switches at the time, and you just give it a software upgrade, and now you have solved the IP over ATM problem. Okay, not even a hardware upgrade. You don't have to actually change any hardware. You can leverage existing hardware or your existing hardware which you have deployed. Like if people have already deployed ATM networks and they're like really struggling with the IP over ATM problem, they can solve that using just a software upgrade which is provided by Ypsilon. Okay, so that was a fairly compelling thing. Okay, and what happened is, as with anything compelling, a lot of people try to develop competing products. So Cisco came up with his own thing, and then IBM and every other company came up with their own thing. Okay, so then to solve this problem, they formed a new standards body. Okay, so if you look at Ypsilon's IP switching, it revolutionized the concept of taking of the hybrid internetworking model. Okay, now if you look at this, it is in fact you are trying to internetwork IP in ATM, but internetworking doesn't mean necessarily that you should keep the integrity of both the protocols. You can actually mix the protocol features. You're creating a hybrid network to solve the internetworking problem. Okay, so that was the key revolution they came, but they made some strategic mistakes. One of the key mistakes which was made by Ypsilon was that they used to set up a ATM virtual circuit whenever a new IP flow came up. Okay, whenever an IP flow is defined as like a TCP flow. So whenever a TCP flow showed up at the edge of the network, this Epsilon protocol would figure out, okay, now I want to set up a virtual circuit for this. So for these, even these tiny flows, remember that the IP flows are fairly tiny. I mean, they're just 10 packets each. If you take a web flow, right, it'll just have a small, it's a TCP flow which will have about 10 packets. For these 10 packets, I have to set up a virtual circuit. So one would think it was brain dead, right? So, but they were so confident about their fast signaling protocol, which was called GSMP, Generic Switch Management Protocol, which was shown to be very simple. Okay, they just wrote in 2,000 lines of code, etc. So the big problem with that IP switching was the virtual circuit explosion. Okay, this gave an opportunity for Cisco to step in, and they came up with a protocol called tag switching. Okay, so the tag switching was, in fact, a more faithful realization of what Epsilon might have really wanted to do. It took the IP routing protocol, that is, it took OSPF and BGP and so on, and then it did not, it essentially set up label switching tables or this label swapping tables using IP routing protocols. Okay, so you don't set up a virtual circuit for every new pack or every new flow. These virtual circuits are already pre-set up for you. Just like in IP, these routing tables or forwarding tables in IP are set up in the background, right? You have no idea when they are set up, okay? And you have no control over what the, when where they are being set up to. So similarly, what tag switching proposed was, let me move this virtual circuit setup, which is actually a control plane function, indeed to the control plane. I don't want it to drive this control plane operation when a flow shows up, okay? I can pre-set up this, and therefore I can aggregate flows. In other words, for instance, if two TCP flows are going from New York to Los Angeles, I don't need to set up a separate virtual circuit for each of them. I can set up one aggregate circuit for them. Okay. Now, this was, in fact, I mean, one of the momentous times. I mean, so once they realized this, then it became obvious that this is the way to go. Okay. So tag switching became enormously popular in very short order. Okay. So this is, it's called control-driven VC setup, okay, as opposed to data-driven VC setup. Okay. This words data-driven and control-driven are borrowed from IP multicast terminology. Okay, if you study IP multicast routing protocols, it also has a similar way of operation. Where in IP multicast trees, to set up the tree, right, it's a much more complicated operation than setting up paths, single paths. So what they do is there are two ways to do that. One is when the IP multicast data traffic actually comes, at that point you sort of trigger a tree setup algorithm. That's called a data-driven multicast tree approach. Or the other approach is, whenever receivers show up at different LANs, you slowly sort of form a tree even before data is there for the tree itself. Okay, that was called a control-driven approach. So exactly in the same analogy, the VC setup or the virtual circuit setup can be either control-driven or data-driven. Okay, and Cisco realized that the control-driven is the way to go. Okay, but one limitation of tag switching, at least at the time it was proposed, was that it would take an IP routing protocol unmodified, and then use ATM forwarding protocol unmodified, okay? And it'll just call the, instead of using the word label, it used the word tag. That's the only difference. But it used to map it actually to the ATM virtual circuit field, and it used to map it to frame relay field, okay? So the key difference which came about later was that it was realized that you don't need to really use IP's control plane, okay? You can use a different routing protocol other than IP control plane. Okay, so what remains in today's MPLS is that the data plane uses label switching, but the control plane doesn't necessarily use IP control protocols. Okay, I'll talk about that in a moment. So as I said, there was a quick alphabet soup that developed. Okay, within a few years, there were at least five or six manufacturers of this concept. Okay, and then to resolve this chaos, a group was formed in the IETF called MPLS. Okay, so the broad concept is very simple. Okay, so I want to route at the edge, or I want to do this complex and slow IP processing, which is called routing, at the edge of the network. And then I want to build a fairly scalable core network, a very large core, hundreds and thousands of switches, which does label switching internally. Therefore, I can build really high-speed networks. That is the idea. So IP packets would come in, and then you would sort of insert these labels into these IP packets. And these labels would be switched between, that's why it's called label switching, okay, or label swapping. This is very similar to how ATM labels are changed. And remember when I discussed about labels, one of the key ideas in labels is it has a local significance. This label makes sense only on this link and at this switch. If I take this label and bring it over here, it will not make any sense. Okay? So whereas an IP address is global. So it uses the IP address instead of an ATM address as the global address to form a path, which is also known as a label switched path, and then it essentially sets up these tables here, which will have the label entries and label mappings, and packets will show up. They'll be, you will append or you will insert these labels, and these will be swapped. Okay, and interestingly, these labels can be mapped almost unchanged to ATM hardware, and it can also be mapped to existing ATM switches. So you could take existing ATM switches and upgrade them to offer MPLS. Okay, so it was a very a key development, okay, primarily market driven. So as with any technology, especially networking, we always come up with its own suite of acronyms, which are these are just a sampling of the acronyms, a lot more, okay. But all these ideas are very simple. Idea-wise, they're all the same, okay. Now, when I say labels distribution protocol, is something which is like a simplified signaling protocol. So essentially, they said ATM signaling protocol has all this junk, okay. I don't need all this stuff. I just throw it out and form a very simple signaling protocol and come down to the essentials. The signaling protocol is just supposed to map a destination address to labels. Okay, that's what it does. So label distribution protocol does that. There turns out to be an alternate way of doing this, and there was another protocol called RSVP, which was also adapted to do label distribution. Okay, and then the virtual circuit is now renamed to be label switched path. Okay, now IETF is guilty of the following crime. Okay, it takes ideas from ATM world and other worlds, okay, but it gives them new names and said that it invented it. Okay, so should keep that in mind. Okay, so the fact that they are given different names is not without a purpose. Okay, then the another when we learnt about T1 lines and permanent virtual circuits and so on, right? I told you or even OCN and all that, right? These are aggregates. Okay, so in the telephony world, you can only create traffic aggregates which are multiples of 64 kilobit per second. But in the data world, you can create arbitrary data aggregates. Okay, and so as usual, IETF gave a new name for them. It's called forwarding equivalence class. It doesn't tell you that it's an aggregate. Okay, but it is. Okay, what it does is it takes traffic. You can groom it into aggregates, and these aggregates are called FECs. Okay, not to be confused with the FEC which we encounter in reliability, not forward error correction. Okay, it's called forwarding equivalence class, which are just traffic aggregates, and then you can form a path through this network called an LSP and then map this aggregate to an LSP. Okay, this problem is called traffic engineering. Okay, traffic engineering essentially means I need to be able to form aggregates of traffic in flexible manners for different purposes, whether it's for quality of service, whether it's for survivability, or whether it's for reroute, etc., etc., and then map this aggregate to a path that is independently set up or set up in a decoupled manner. Okay, so that is what MPLS provides. You can set up LSPs, you can define FECs and map these two. And the boxes which do MPLS are known as label switching routers. Okay, it's like pretty much an ATM switch. Okay, it doesn't have ATM control plane, that's all. And an edge router that does both IP and MPLS. And internally, these fellows don't do IP. Okay, so MPLS is basically, in essence, is just label switching as a paradigm. It is multi-protocol in the sense that it supports a wide variety of protocols both above it and below it. So it can be mapped to ATM, it can be mapped to PPP, it can be mapped to SONET, it can be mapped to a lot of stuff. Okay, and above it, you can use IP, you can use non-IP, etc. Okay, so with that, then everything becomes obvious. Okay, so now, essentially what happens is take an IP packet, and earlier you were sort of dumping it into ATM cells, right? One of the problems with ATM was you had to sort of chop up this into 53 byte cells. Now, MPLS does not have this restriction. You just put an, just like in ATM, you would put a cell header, right? And the most important thing in the cell header was a label, right? So MPLS gives you a label. So it takes the essence of ATM forwarding, says that I need a label. So I give you a 32-bit MPLS header, which is mostly a label. Okay, that's what it is. And then you're essentially encapsulating this. So this is MPLS appears as though it's a link layer for IP. It picks up the packet and then establishes this label switch path and shuttles the packet through the label switch path without actually segmenting it and reassembling it on the other side. That's the only difference. Okay, so another cool feature which MPLS provides is this concept of a label stack. If you remember, ATM provides two types of virtual circuit identifiers. One is called a VCI and another is called a VPI. Okay, that's one stands for permanent virtual circuit, and then the other is for a switched virtual circuit, right? So MPLS extends that idea and says that why just have two? You can have more than two. Okay, in general, if you want to map MPLS onto a non-ATM network, you can have arbitrary number of levels in this hierarchy of labels. So this again mirrors, if you see, ideas of SONET, right? In SONET, you can have you can take OC3 or OC1 and then map to OC3, OC3s to OC12s, etc., right? So similarly, you can do several levels of aggregation, and these logical levels of aggregation can be defined by a level of labels, okay? So and then, so for example, you can have a label switch paths which converge at a point, and then you create a sort of a bigger pipe, sort of encapsulate these smaller pipes into the bigger pipe. And so the reason you can do that is you can reduce the number of table entries at the intermediate routers. So just like an IP world, you wanted to reduce the number of table entries in IP routing tables by having aggregated IP addresses. Here you have stacked MPLS labels to achieve the same purpose. Okay. So another side effect of it, or probably the main reason why this was done, is called nested tunneling. Okay. Nested tunnels means that when you put a label, right, essentially you're taking an IP or a non-IP packet and sending it from one side to the other. As far as user is concerned, they have a pipe from one side to the other, from one CPE box to the other customer premises box. That's what CPE stands for. And this is pretty much like frame relay. Okay, and remember, frame relay provided you the notion of a closed user group, which means that my traffic will not go to anybody else. And for this traffic, I can define a quality of service, which is like CIR. So those were the big attributes. So organizations can form private networks using MPLS tunnels instead of frame relay tunnels, and you will have a much more simplified IP mapping. And you can also do the same thing within an ISP. You can form virtual private networks with this. One of the key ideas of virtual private networks, like anything virtual, is you need to have a physical network, and then you have this sort of logical virtual network, and you map the two, right? So the tunnels are a key way of mapping. Okay, tunnels give you the primitive to take traffic, create a network, and then map that to actual physical hardware. Okay, so that is what a tunnel does. So tunnel is a very important idea in virtual networking. And the idea of a private network means two things. One is a closed user group, my traffic doesn't go to others. And the other piece of privacy is that, security. I mean, so you have to encrypt the whole thing and so on. So IP security and so on is done. IPsec is done to secure the traffic going on VPNs. So when you hear the word VPN, normally it usually involves a tunneling protocol. MPL is not the only way of doing tunneling, but it's a fairly flexible way of doing tunneling, especially for an ISP. Okay, these are the things which an ISP likes in it. So in terms of the header, it's very, very simple. Okay, the 20 bits of the header is a label. And then 8 bits, you just copy the TTL field from IP and throw it here. This was necessary to avoid loops. Okay, so this is just a technical problem. There were 3 bits which are experimental, so don't ignore this. And then there was 1 bit which tells you whether there's a label stack. Okay, now if this bit is 1, then it says that there's one more stack entry. Okay, so pretty much like that more fragments bit, right, we saw. It's a very similar way of encoding stacks. Okay, so this is again the same thing. Okay, so, in brief, the abstract notion of a label can be mapped to a lot of lower level technologies. In the ATM, you map it to BPI or VCI. In the frame relay, you map it to DLCI. Okay, all this sounds familiar now, right? In TDM, you can map a label to a time slot. Okay, now the label now has become even more abstract at this point. Okay, so you don't necessarily have to have a field. You can even map it to a time slot. So through synchronization, you can figure it out. In X.25, it's the LCN field. And there are other proprietary mechanisms for doing this. And more interestingly, as optical networks start coming through, you can map a label to a frequency or to a wavelength. Okay, so this is called generalized MPLS, where a label can actually denote a light frequency. So instead of, when you say label switching, right, you're actually switching from one light wavelength to the other. So when you do wavelength conversion and so on, it can be actually controlled through an MPLS-like infrastructure. So MPLS is now being positioned as a very sophisticated control plane, but it's lightweight, okay, and it solves all the mapping problems. So once you come to MPLS, you have all these flexible features of controlling a network and doing fancy things in terms of running an operational network. Okay, so that's why a lot of big ISPs, particularly AT&T and some of the other major players, are going for MPLS and for GMPLS. Yeah. We'll study this in more detail later. Okay, so label encapsulation. Okay, I'm going to skip all this thing. Okay, this is exactly what I said. So if I have sometimes called a shim label. Okay, so shim basically means a very thin header. That's what it means. So I just have a 32-bit header that I sort of sneak in. Okay, that's why it's called shim. So they take the IP payload, tag on a shim label, and then you can either map it directly onto existing networks, or if I want to map it to Ethernet or PPP, I can sort of, instead of having a direct mapping, I'll have an indirect mapping. I'll have to modify the hardware there. Okay. So I'm not going to go through the stuff. I just put this in details. Anyway, so those slides essentially tell you that, those give you some more details about how IP is mapped, the MPLS can be mapped to ATM, frame relay, etc. Okay, let's cut to the chase and see how the basic operation works, right? So essentially, I have an MPLS network. This looks like United States, I hope. Okay, IP packet shows up with a destination address 134.blah.blah.blah. Okay, now, excuse me. So the destination is over here. Okay, now assuming that I can do some kind of an ARP thing. Okay, I can run one single ARP server for this entire network. Okay, now I don't have to break this up into smaller LISs. Right, that's one big advantage. So even though the server-based resolution is a pain, I can still run one server in my network operation center and figure out what the mapping is. Okay, once I figure that out, and by the way, to do that, I don't need to establish a virtual circuit to that. Okay, I can have a backend thing where I can just send a connectionless message to that server. Okay, now, essentially, once I figured out that this fellow is over here, 134.112 is over here, I want to set up a circuit. I want to set up a virtual circuit, or what is known as a label switch path. Now I'll just set up a signaling message which goes here and set up the labels over here. And assume that the labels here are these numbers. Okay, notice that the labels are different over here. So at every hop, a packet will now carry a label called 1965 over here. And when it comes to Santa Fe, the label will be swapped. Okay, and then finally it will be swapped and you go back here. Okay. So the only difference is that now you have to actually run a signaling protocol to set this up. Okay, now at RPI we've come up with an ingenious protocol where you can even get rid of the signaling. Okay, you don't even have to do the signaling. Okay, so we'll study that again next class. Okay, but so that is a way in which you don't even have to do MPLS. So you can just take existing IP, existing routing protocols, and you can modify that to do essentially what MPLS can do. Okay, it'll minus some of the more detailed features of MPLS. What you can do. In fact, we are going to deploy this on the internet very soon. Okay, and Seth here is actually working on that stuff. Okay, okay. So essentially, the label setup means that you have to go and set up these intermediate tables. Okay, so this looks like a mess. So let's look at what happens here. So when I have a regular IP address, it looks like this 47.3 and so on. But when I'm talking about labels, these are the small numbers 1, 3, etc. So when an IP packet comes, you will refer to a forwarding table, and normally regular IP forwarding will just not touch the destination address. Remember that one of the big differences in label switching versus IP forwarding is that the IP addresses are untouched. You use the IP addresses for forwarding, but you don't modify the IP addresses in the packet itself. So packet header, you don't touch. Okay, so you go like this, and you crank through the network and land up on the side. IP address is unchanged. Okay. Now you got out. Okay. Now MPLS, once you have done the label distribution, for doing the label distribution, when I want to communicate from here to here, I still have this sort of a signaling model where I want to request the labels for 47.1. Okay, and this request sort of propagates all the way to 47.1, and then you set up a label over here. Okay, and then you give the label mapping information to the previous router, and this fellow sets up another label over here. So, and look at this table. What does it say? It says that, okay, let's look at from this table. The destination is 47.1. For this destination, I assign label, what is this, 0.4, okay? And then I send this back, okay? And this fellow here will say that I have an outgoing label of 0.4, and I assign 0.5 as a new incoming label. And I will give this mapping to the previous node. The previous node will say that, okay, my incoming packet is not an MPLS packet, it's an IP packet, but now I am responsible for inserting this label 0.5 into the packet. Okay, and when the packet shows up here, okay, so essentially what it looks like is I've created this virtual pipe. from the source to destination. Okay, as far as the, so this is the abstraction. That's why it's called virtual, right? So there's an abstraction from the source to destination. As far as IP is concerned, I have come up with a packet which has destination 47.1, and this whole thing looks like a single IP hop. So in fact, this looks like a single next hop for IP. Okay, but internally there is multiple hops. Okay, so when an IP packet comes here, it jumps the single next hop. In fact, if you want to do IP routing, you need to maintain adjacencies only between this node and this node. So you don't need to maintain all the forwarding adjacencies between every pair of intermediate nodes and so on, which is a big problem in IP overlay over ATM, right? So here you just need to maintain adjacencies from here to here once you have set up this pipe. Okay, that's the basic idea. So the packet comes here and shuttles off three here. So what I've talked about is a general LSP. Okay, one thing I did not talk about in great detail was that for this entire destination prefix, I have assigned one label. Okay, remember that in true label switching or in true ATM, right, you have a separate label for every virtual circuit. Okay, so what that means is, suppose I have another virtual circuit that shows up this way, right, comes from here, goes like this and goes here, it will still use the same label in this architecture. Okay, so what happens is that essentially this whole thing is, instead of separate virtual circuits, it's essentially like a tree. Okay, so if all these flows want to go out to this egress node, okay, these are the label allotments. Okay, so essentially you seem to have an aggregated pipe here, and this aggregated pipe contains the sub pipes and so on and so forth. So the number of table entries is minimized in this architecture. So this is like a tree. Okay, this we generally call a vanilla link state LS path. Okay, so this is the way it goes. Whereas what is more interesting in MPLS is the fact that you can actually cut this whole thing out and you can form your own explicit LSP. Explicit LSP is very simple. What it means is that you have a human or a computer that decides, that takes the topology of this network, okay, which you can get by just sending out link state announcements around this network, even if you don't do full OSP routing. And then it can come up with some arbitrary path from source to destination. And then it can say that, okay, you are the signaling protocol, LDP or RSVP, take this explicit path I give you and go and set it up. Okay, so remember that here in the prior LSP setup, right, I was at the mercy of the existing paths that have already been set up. So here, suppose I want to allocate a different quality of service for this path and this path, I couldn't do it. Whereas in an explicit routed LSP, I can do that. So this is essentially what it says is that I can give you source routing flexibility. Okay, now source routing is very important, because when you studied PNNI, I said that once you are able to do source routing, you can, what does source routing mean? That I can come up with an explicit path and I can nail down that path. Okay, now that's a very important attribute, because once I've nailed down that path, I can optionally also nail down some resources for that path, which means I can start offering quality of service on top of MPLS with this architecture without the heavyweight nature of PNNI. Okay, I don't need to actually go into a complete PNNI model. I can come up with an OSPF variant that can set up quality of service paths. And then this basically triggered an enormous amount of study into quality of service, alternate quality of service routing protocols, okay, which we'll not go through. So if you're interested, you can look at that in your term paper. Okay, so essentially what happens here is that you can, instead of going in that prior path, you can set up your own path. And the only thing here is you are specifying the path, and that path is mapped to local labels. Okay. Now, as I mentioned, in the architecture which we have developed at RPI, we can do exactly the same thing, but without the signaling. So we'll study again that later. Okay, so in explicitly routed LSP, you can have alternate pipes. You can decide where the pipe should be routed through, and you can route the pipe through this MPLS network. That's the basic idea. Okay, so when a packet comes, you can map it through either of these pipes. Okay, so you have complete flexibility at the edge to determine where your packet should be going. Okay, so why do we care about this? Because operators don't just want to build a network, they want to make money out of it. So one of the ways of making money is just to support the best effort internet. Another way is to provide business services, right? Like providing a voice over IP or virtual private network. So you can, once I have routing flexibility, I can do a lot of fancy things. I can nail down routes, preferential routes. I can start assigning quality of service to them. I can basically co-opt all the great ideas that were developed in ATM, but at a much reduced complexity in this architecture. Okay, so I'm not constrained to shortest path. Okay, there was a lot of study to show that shortest path doesn't gain you a lot in quality of service. Suppose I have a shortest path from Los Angeles to New York and there's a lot of traffic, I can't do anything, I'm powerless in shortest path algorithm. Whereas in an explicitly routed algorithm, I can have multiple paths. I can have multiple paths which are not necessarily shortest in the link state sense, okay, or in the Dijkstra sense. You can come up with non-shortest paths, but they can have lots of resources. Okay, so, but then like any other standards body, they ran into trouble. Okay, there were two competing factions and two signaling protocols were developed. One protocol was called LDP, okay, and one version of that is called CRLDP, or what's known as constraint routing LDP. Okay, you can just basically think of it as LDP with explicit routing capabilities. And then there was another protocol from the remnants of history called RSVP, which was developed in a quality of service framework for IP, which went nowhere. Okay, so then Cisco had already implemented this in most of its boxes. So then it saw that RSVP could be easily extended to do similar functions like LDP. So they came up and extended RSVP to have explicit routing capabilities and some scalability extensions. Okay, so today both of these exist. Okay, so if you look at Lucent and I think some of Nortel implement CRLDP, all Cisco boxes implement this. Okay, and most probably RSVP will win. Okay, so when MPLS was designed, right, one of the big reasons why people were so excited about this was the prospect of building high-speed networks. Okay, was the prospect of building really scalable high-speed networks. It is not a big deal to build a very high-speed switches, because in by mid-80s or late 80s, people already knew how to build high-speed packet forwarding engines. Okay, what that meant is it's essentially in basic ATM switch. If you throw out its signaling and look at the forwarding capability, people knew how to build high-speed switches by that time. But now if I want to build a network, which is a different proposition, which need to have all this control plane and so on, people came up with a high-speed ATM network, but it was meaningless because all the traffic existed and all the applications were on top of IP. And they had this huge phase for a few years trying to map one on top of the other, never worked out. And then suddenly when this mapping problem was solved, there was this prospect of building high-speed networks, which is different from just high-speed switches. So there was suddenly an explosion of innovation, and lots of new products came out with dramatically higher speed than before. Okay, in fact, even faster than older ATM switches. Okay, so ATM was immediately trumped, and so suddenly you started having high-speed MPLS switches and so on. Okay, so but then also another issue which came up was that so MPLS seemed to be well positioned as a technology that can allow you to build high-speed switches, but suddenly some really smart people got together and developed algorithms for IP forwarding. Okay, IP forwarding, if you recall, has what is known as a longest prefix match problem. Okay, whenever, and it has a detailed history, okay, you should actually look at the IP internet protocols course for all this details. Essentially, you just can't take an IP address and match it to one routing table entry and forward it. You have to find multiple matches and take the longest of those matches. Okay, so each of these matches is known as a prefix match. So longest prefix match means that you have to take the longest match and send it along that direction. Okay, this is a restriction placed by one of BGP's extensions known as CIDR. Okay, so this longest prefix match, if you do it the naive way, basically means suppose I have a routing table with 100,000 entries. I have to go and crank through this entire table when a packet shows up and match the destination address to all possible matches. So I might get one or more matches. And then I have to take the longest of this match and send out. Okay, it's like an order n type of thing. Okay, so then people came up with some, instead of doing it in order n, you can do it in order log n by developing a simple tree type data structure. And then what was realized was that you can make it even more faster, almost close to order one in practice, by having what is known as a tri data structure, T-R-I-E, which we shall discuss in the next class. There it was, and then doing very smart hardware modifications. So then suddenly what happened was that IP forwarding could also be done at gigabit speeds. Okay, that time gigabit routers was a big deal. Okay, in fact, there was a big paper published by Craig Partridge on how to build a gigabit router. And he goes extensively into the problem of actually just the IP forwarding problem. And there have been several survey papers published on IP high-speed IP forwarding. Okay, that will be on your reading list later. But anyway, so IP forwarding was solved as a high-speed forwarding problem was solved. Okay, then what that meant was, Now I can figure out from which input port to go to which output port very fast in IP itself. So now all I need is a high-speed switching fabric that can shuttle my packet from the input to output. So what they did was they just co-opted ATM switches. They went to the ATM box, just threw out the covers, and just took the switch fabric, and then they put this new forwarding algorithm. They built a new box and called it an IP router. So IP routers, which are traditionally slow, like these cranky machines, now they became extremely high-speed forwarding engines. And now they started competing with MPLS. Now MPLS had all this other baggage, right? You had to have a signaling protocol. Now they said, now you can have a connectionless forwarding system without any signaling, blah, blah, okay, and it can forward at high speeds, right? So why do you need MPLS? So the rationale for MPLS suddenly became attacked. Okay, so the way it survived or is still surviving is that MPLS uses its lightweight and flexible signaling capability to do other things, okay, and that other thing was called traffic engineering. Okay, and the traffic engineering capability means that, I mean, what do you mean by engineering? I have traffic and traffic is valuable, and so I have to engineer it so that I get the maximum value out of it, right? So essentially, as I mentioned, the basic idea of traffic engineering is I want to be able to define flexible traffic aggregates and map them onto paths of my choice and then protect some traffic for survivability reasons or then have quality of service assigned to traffic, etc. Excuse me. So broadly, it means I want to do performance optimization of operational IP networks. And IP, the basic, even though you had fast forwarding capabilities, the IP routing protocols were too clunky to be able to do that. Okay, OSPF and BGP were still, too horrible to do that. Anyway, so in particular, OSPF and BGP offer only a single path. Okay, in particular, OSPF offers only a shortest path. So suppose I have lots of traffic and I want to do some load balancing on my network, right? So I want to take my traffic from, which is going from, we saw that traffic from Los Angeles to Santa Fe to Boston or somewhere, right, like New York. I want to remap this traffic to go from Los Angeles to Colorado to New York, right? The only way I could do it was indirectly. I couldn't directly set up a path through Colorado to map this traffic. What I had to do was I had to go and change link weights. Okay, that was the only mechanism. You had to go and tweak link weights. And by changing link weights, you will have a flood of LSPs going around, and OSPF will now see a new topology with new weights, and it will recompute the shortest path. And then effectively, you can transfer traffic from one path to the other, but not only will you do that, you will also affect other traffic going elsewhere. Okay, so this becomes a basic optimization problem. You don't want to mess up traffic going elsewhere, but I want to change some, move some traffic from one point to other. So fine-grained manipulation of traffic aggregates and mapping them to particular paths became a big problem. Okay, it was not possible to do it in IP. So MPLS, one of the major reasons it survives is because you can do that. Okay, and as I said, in RPI, one of the reasons our work is so important is that we have shown how to do that even within IP without actually going to MPLS. Okay, so again, the rationale continues to be challenged. So in IP, if I want to go to capture the problem, essentially the idea is this. So the idea of shortest path, one of the main ideas of a shortest path is that a subset of a shortest path, okay, or a subpath of a shortest path is also the shortest path. Okay, the implication is like this. If I have traffic which goes from A to E and the shortest path is A, B, D, E, then if I have some other traffic which goes from A to D, it will also go from A, B, D. Okay, now consider why this might be an issue. Now obviously, these links are overloaded. Okay. Now, if I want to resolve the overload situation or I want to do some load balancing and I want to get some traffic off this links, right, I can do some fancy thing, which is instead of, if you look at the earlier case, I had 1, 1, 2, and all these are all link weights, okay? I can go and fool with these link weights and change them. So I can do instead of 1, 1, I made it 1, 4. Okay, but what you did right now is not only did you change the traffic from A to E, you also changed the traffic from A to D. So now this is the new shortest path, right? Obviously, shortest path, you add these link weights, right? This is shortest in terms of sum of link weights. But unfortunately, you have now swapped the entire traffic from one, you're basically thrashing, okay? In operating systems, you call this thrashing, okay? So you're thrashing your traffic from one side to the other, okay? Not to mention, I mean, this, first of all, this is pretty horrible, but for a user, it's even more horrible. If I'm running an actual voice over IP session, your call will be dropped, okay? I don't know whether you guys have called long distance over voice over IP connections, okay? Since we call to India, sometimes we get these cheapo phone cards, which you can do voice over IP to India, okay, very cheap, but you have this kind of thing, okay. So somebody will swap my traffic to a different path and my call be dropped. Okay, so this is one of the big problems. But you cannot do this with OSPF. What is this? I want to send one part of the traffic over here and another part of the traffic. This is true load balancing, right? And this you can do with explicit, some form of explicit routing. So I want to explicitly say that for this traffic aggregate from A to D, I want to be able to define that traffic aggregate in any way I want, okay, flexibly. And I want to map that traffic aggregate to an explicitly routed path. Okay, this is the essence of traffic engineering. Okay, now along with this basic function, you can try all the other kinds of tricks. You can have backup paths, survivability, etc. Okay, so as I said, why not traffic engineering with TE stands for traffic engineering? Why can't I do it with OSPF or BGP? Because they were not designed to do it. Okay, they were only, and even if you try to change them, they are still a single path routing. You can't, you have to do some fundamental extension. And the only hook they provide is you can tweak some parameters. In other words, you can parametrically sort of tweak them to give you, or I mean, essentially give you what you want. But this can only be done in practice at high granularities. Okay, it means that you cannot do fine-grained traffic engineering, or you cannot do fine-grained policy mapping of traffic. And you also have to assume that the incoming and outgoing traffic is what is known as quasi-static. Okay, if the traffic itself is highly variable, right? Suppose I have a lot of traffic from Los Angeles to New York and then from Los Angeles to Colorado, right? So suddenly I assume that this is going to be static. In other words, this statistics are going to be stationary, like mean is going to be the same, variance is going to be the same, and then I map this stuff. Then by the time I mapped, it's already changed. Okay, then I'll have to tweak again and then try to remap, and the entire network is thrashing. Okay, this, by the way, if you remember, in the old ARPANET, this is exactly what happened. In the old ARPANET, they had what is known as a traffic-sensitive routing scheme, which used to do this in an automated fashion. Essentially, when there was overload on a path, it used to automatically change the link weights such that traffic would get out of that path. Okay, link would become expensive if it was overloaded. That's exactly what happened. And then it became extremely unstable because as soon as there was overload on one path, you would change the paths, and you'll send out this whole bunch of link state advertisements, and traffic will change. And by the way, it'll overload some other path, and then you'll swap back, right? So this whole thrashing thing used to happen in ARPANET. That was one of the big problems in early routing. And they solved it by making sure they don't change the link weights often. But now, even if I want to change link weights, you come back to the same old problems, like back to the future, right? So it's not very great. Okay, so so that is one of the big advantages of MPLS, where because the basic routing protocols are fundamentally limited by the single path nature, whether it's the shortest path or a policy path in BGP case, all the flows to a single destination prefix are mapped to the same path. You can't do anything about it. And if you want to change the mapping of the traffic, you can't just do that. You must also change the route. Okay, this is what I mean by coupling the problem of traffic mapping to the problem of routing, okay, or to the problem of route availability. Okay, and by the way, this has all kinds of other nice problems which come along with it, which is called like routing instabilities. Okay, by the way, in over the last few years, the internet has experienced a few blackouts. Okay, and these have been caused by several reasons. One of the reasons is because of exactly this. People are trying to do some fancy traffic engineering on their network without knowing they're exporting instability to other networks. Okay, and the entire internet became unstable for some time. Okay, so thankfully it doesn't happen too often, but it still continues to happen. So the OSPF at least has been or is being re-engineered to do high-speed convergence, but BGP is notorious for its convergence. In fact, it takes convergence means that you have stable routes, right? In other words, you have stable and valid routes. You don't have a route which leads to a black hole, right? So to converge, suppose one link goes down or some change happens, right? To converge to stable routes, in OSPF, it originally takes a few seconds, but now it's being re-engineered to happen under a sub-second. But there's also that it's not yet done today, but it's happening right now. But in BGP, it still takes on the average of 15 to 30 minutes for it to converge today. Okay, I'm not talking about history, it's today. Okay, so imagine what will happen if you do this to BGP. Okay, so essentially, if you want to do inter-domain traffic engineering, that is, if you want to do fancy traffic mappings across domains, okay, and there are many good reasons for doing this, because especially you're paying money to get connectivity to the external world, so people want to do that, but it turns out that this can cause lots of problems. So traffic mapping in traditional protocols is coupled with the problem of the route being available itself. Now, MPLS has a beautiful property that you can set up a path independent of what traffic is being mapped to that. And then at your leisure, you can form up a traffic aggregate called an FEC or a forwarding equivalence class and then map that traffic aggregates. See, this again revisits the concept of indirection, right? Indirection always gives you dramatic flexibility. You can form this virtual resource called a traffic aggregate, and then you have another physical resource called the path, and you have an indirection or a mapping between the two. You don't couple it. If you couple it, you'll have this kind of problem. Okay, so in traffic engineering, basically you set up paths. So if this is the shortest path, you can also set up a traffic engineered path, and you can then map a particular destination prefix to particular paths. That's what it means in practice. So even though New York has two prefixes, there's 192.star and 134.star, you don't have to map all of them to a single path. You can map them to separate paths. Okay, that's what it means. And then what you can do is at the edge router, called the LER or label edge router, you can flexibly define traffic aggregates, assign the traffic aggregate a label, okay, and then by assigning them a label, essentially mapping it to a label switch path. Okay, so that's what this thing means. And to this aggregate, you can also offer quality of service guarantees. Maybe it's a nice path, maybe it's a path which is protected, maybe it's a path which has given quality of service guarantees. Okay, so if paths, if these packets come together, you can form an aggregate. Both of these form an equivalence class. That's what this thing means. And there's an equivalence class for the purposes of forwarding. What that means is you get the same label. Okay, and the same service, that's what it means. So you can have some guarantees over here across this path. Okay, so the summary is this. MPLS provides a lightweight signal traffic engineering abstraction where it decouples or makes orthogonal the problem of traffic mapping and the actual choice of a route and its setup. That is the fundamental thing which it does. And the fundamental idea of signaling has now been reduced to the concept of mapping global IDs to local IDs. And what we shall learn next class is that there is another cuter way to do this. You don't need to even map global IDs to local IDs. You can essentially avoid signaling by just remaining with global IDs and actually deriving local IDs directly from global IDs without running a signaling protocol. Okay, so that's a new thing that's happening right now. And FEC is a mechanism for defining traffic aggregates, and multi-level tunneling is provided through label stacking mechanisms. But the issue is that all this MPLS stuff is still valid only within a single domain. You cannot cross multiple domains with this stuff. But still it's been fairly valuable. A lot of ISP domains are building large autonomous systems with MPLS-based networks. Interestingly, people are also building large autonomous systems with OSPF-based routing. Okay, but both of them have their trade-offs and so on. Okay, and today one of the big issues is MPLS cannot go beyond area boundaries very efficiently, or it cannot go beyond autonomous system boundaries for sure. Okay, there's no meaning for inter-domain MPLS. So, but the concept of traffic engineering still can be inter-domain. Okay, so those are the research challenges right now. Okay, and another sort of distinction is we saw in IP we do what is known as hop-by-hop routing or connectionless routing, where you have, so you can think of this as like background routing which sets up your forwarding table. And here the opposite is called explicit or source routing, where the edge router figures out a source by whatever means once it has a map, and then you signal that. Okay, so what we're going to continue next class is to show how you can do that signaling function through a bunch of signaling protocols. And one of the more popular protocols is called RSVP. Okay, we'll study this next class. Thank you.